Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This season of The Solo Collective is brought to you by PensionBee, an easy way to combine your existing pensions or start a new one. PensionBee is a leading online pension provider and has enabled thousands of people to feel pension confident. I feel quite strongly about pensions. For a big chunk of my solo working life, I didn't have a pension, just an old workplace pension that I'd automatically contributed to in my early 20s. I have sorted things out now, though. I also feel strongly about women getting pensions. Women typically face an income gap of 38% compared to men when they retire in the UK, which is down to a combination of lower pay throughout our careers, taking career breaks to care for others, and women just not having their own pensions at all. This even leads to female pensioners living in poverty, as many as 1 in 5 in the UK. Download the app or head to pensionbee.com for more information. Your capital is at risk. I'm really delighted that this season is sponsored by Tide Business Current Accounts. I'm a Tide customer myself. It's where the account for my photography studio lives, and I've been really pleased with how they've looked after us for the last few years. They make it really easy for sole traders and freelancers to set up business accounts for free, with handy tools like accounting integrations, invoicing, and much more. People often think that your money isn't protected in a challenger bank or app-based bank, but Tide has FSCS protection in the UK, just like traditional bank accounts. Tide is dedicated to small businesses, and whenever I've needed help, the people on the app's chat function have been super responsive. Tide helps me grow my business. Go to tide.co or download the app today to find out more about getting started. Hello and welcome back to The Solo Collective. It's lovely to have you here. Today we're talking about time, and I'm talking about time with Oliver Berkman, who is the author of a fantastic book about time. It's called 4,000 Weeks, Time and How to Use It. And if you don't know Oliver Berkman, he's a brilliant writer. He was for a very long time a journalist at The Guardian and had a column called This Column Will Change Your Life, which started off being about self-help and personal development and then kind of moved into broader philosophical issues. And it was just brilliant. It ran for 12 years, which is a measure of how good it was, and stopped just a couple of years back. And he's very good at unpicking big concepts and making them more manageable. And this book is no exception. It's sort of about time management, but it's actually as much about relinquishing the idea that we can ever truly manage our time in the first place, which I found so refreshing and relieving. I definitely encourage you to have a read of it. He's also written several other excellent books, and he has an email newsletter, which is really good too, called The Imperfectionist. He, until recently, lived in New York, and now he lives in North Yorkshire Moors, which is somewhat different. And you might hear a few animal noises in the background as we have our conversation. I'm really excited to talk to you because I feel like this is an unfair thing to say, but I sort of feel like I've read so much of what you've done that I sort of feel like I know you. And also,
oh no, that's a great that's a compliment, but yes.
One of the first things I like to find out for this podcast is what your solo working life looks like, or feels like, maybe that's a more appropriate way of putting it, and kind of how much time you spend on your own doing your work and what the space looks like that you work in.
This is all totally, it feels like it's in flux, my working situation, but then I'm gradually coming to realize that maybe it's always going to feel like it's in flux and that it's not actually heading for some moment when all the pieces will be completely in place. We live now in the North York Moors, where we moved last autumn from New York, just for now, for the duration of my wife's academic sabbatical. So it's all a little bit provisional in that sense. And we are for now renting a cottage that is usually a holiday rental. My workspace is a living room with a desk in the corner and an old fox hunting related painting that I would not have chosen to furnish it with myself. The days, I basically work alone, except when I'm talking to people online or talking to people at events, or occasionally still interviewing people for my own purposes or doing reporting trips for articles. That tends to be either from kind of early in the morning until it's my turn to go and pick up our son from school, or it tends to be from when I've come back from doing the school run until dinner time.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I struggle with the most, having become a parent, 5-6 years ago now, and all the rest of it, is like there was a time in my 20s and early 30s when I was just the complete master of my days, and that's full of disadvantages, I think, actually, in hindsight. But one of the advantages is you just decide when you're going to be doing your work hours and you do them. The thing that I find quite challenging these days is to be focused and also flexible, because I'm definitely a sort of person who would, left to his own devices, be quite rigid, I think, in my planning and routine and always work at exactly the same time for exactly the same amounts of time. I think it's very useful, but a little challenging to have a lot of pushback on that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I had a slightly different experience of having kids at around the same time. I found the kind of edging of my time that came with having kids to be very useful, because it stopped the sprawl of work. It kind of stopped me, yeah, working till 9 or 10 at night, or not starting till 11 because I could.
Right.
And now that kind of, you know, you get so long from one requirement of you to another, I have found myself to be more efficient, much more efficient actually, in those periods of time than I was when I had when I had all the time.
This is fascinating. I sort of long for that, because I do hear it, that it sounds like you're one of these people who, when they only have 3 hours to play with, is less prone to being distracted by social media for an hour in the middle of that.
I'd love you to think that about me, but I'm not going to pretend that that's true. I think it was more the starting and the finishing that became better. The bits in the middle, maybe not so much, but
right.
it suddenly became easier to start and easier to stop, which were probably my two greater challenges.
Right.
I'm still very drawn to dicking about online, as we might put it.
I think maybe it's, you know, I'm not someone who has ever struggled with insufficient self-discipline. I might well be someone who has struggled with too much of it, and it's just as bad. I'm not trying to sneakily pretend that it's something to be proud of, but like, I would never have had a problem back in the day starting at an early point in the day if I decided I was going to. And so for me, it's like having that autonomy eroded, which it totally has to be, and I'm really happy that it has been, because you don't get anywhere in life, I don't think, anywhere useful and meaningful by just carrying out your own plans for it. You know, getting started was never a problem for me. The problem for me is that I now have to take other people's needs into account when deciding when I'm going to get started. So yeah, I think it's probably just the different ways that people's personality types interact with those life changes.
Yeah. I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but what was it like to read as much self-help and personal development as you did over it was over a decade that you wrote the column, wasn't it? Is that right?
It was, yeah. About 12 years, I think.
Wow. So I wrote this book solo a few years ago, and I had to read a huge amount for it. I loved it, but I also found it quite confounding in some ways, like this kind of swirl of betterment that you could have in your brain at any one moment. And I love self-help, and you know, obviously I'm part of it now because of having written a book, but I also wonder if there's a sort of, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but something slightly dangerous about it, like a sort of self-prescribing, self-medicating kind of aspect to it. Did you ever have that sense? And like, what sort of legacy did it leave you with?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think the only place you're right, I think, about the troublesome aspect of it. The only place I differ is that I think I came ready-made with that troublesome part of my personality, the one that wanted to sort of achieve some kind of either perfection or totally be totally organized or totally capable of doing all the things that I thought I had to do. And so definitely immersing yourself in that stuff for long enough it's kind of enabling. I guess that's the way I think of its bad side.
Yeah.
It's not that it gave me this idea, first of all. And I was basically never, I didn't always want to write my column that week, I suppose, but I was never thinking like, oh, this just isn't me. And I think that the most interesting thing for me in a way was that doing that column for so long and pursuing my sort of pre-existing longings and neuroses for that long was actually really useful in a surprising way, which is that you kind of exhaust them and you achieve a kind of very useful disillusionment. You begin to realize after testing out 50 ways of organizing your day that maybe this particular kind of perfect security and certainty with respect to your time is not available. Maybe there's something wrong with the question you're asking, you know, and you begin, it's actually very useful kind of in a sort of negative sense. And I don't think I could have written the book I wrote most recently about time, for example, unless I had sort of been through that and come to the end of a certain kind of quest. Now that raises an interesting question of what kind of a service was it or wasn't it to its readers if I was using it to sort of explore the failure of that kind of way of thinking. But I think, you know, second half of that time I was doing that column, these ideas were present too. I was partly already seeing this and hopefully helping readers to sort of at least to see what I was pointing to and see if they agreed that actually there was much to be said for questioning that notion that is baked into the most conventional self-help anyway, that read this book and implement these steps and all your problems will go away.
The column for the This Column Will Change Your Life final column was 8 Secrets to a Fairly Fulfilling Life, which I thought was a really neat name. And I wanted to ask, actually, were there any things that you felt particularly would be applicable to solo workers, to people who spend huge amounts of time by themselves, in your 8 secrets?
I mean, I guess one of the things that's in there that probably does get exacerbated for some people by solo work is the imposter syndrome thing, right? The thing about feeling that you're sort of faking it. I have to say, I guess it didn't work this way so much for me by the time I turned into a real solo worker. I definitely have been afflicted by this problem earlier in my life, but I can imagine, again, maybe I'm just speculating here, but I can imagine that for people who do that sort of earlier in their careers, the lack of obvious immediate reinforcement of like having a slot in an organization, you're on your own and standing up for your own skills and abilities and self-discipline in a way that you kind of don't have to in a lot of jobs where you're sort of held in a way by the web of the organization. And so what I was saying in that section there was just like we tend to respond to this problem by trying to build up our confidence and be like, no, you can do it, you're brilliant, you know exactly what you're doing. I think it's a lot more useful to realize that kind of nobody knows exactly what they're doing. And one of the things that you learn if you are a solo worker dealing with large organizations is you may have a certain kind of reverence for them because they are large organizations, but any detailed knowledge of what actually goes on inside them will soon enough disabuse you of that.
Does that kind of chime with your part of the book where you're talking about our own cosmic insignificance? Because I really loved that. I loved the idea that human civilization as a whole is a tiny blip in the history of all things. I think the phrase you used was, you're not going to leave a dent in the universe. So you might as well kind of shrug off the idea that you ever could and live quite joyfully in the knowledge that none of it matters that much.
You're absolutely right about what you said. It has an implication in the way you said it, I think, maybe I'm sort of being defensive, that this is a sort of abandonment of meaning in life in favor of happiness or something.
And,
and one thing I'm sort of always... Yeah, no, fair enough. I'm being defensive.
No, do defend.
one of the points I'm at pains to sort of emphasize is that I don't think that seeing the cosmic insignificance, seeing how small we are in the scheme of things and how little anything we does matters in the scheme of things, I don't think that needs to be a recipe for despair or nihilism or for saying like there's no meaning in anything, but rather for adjusting the standard of meaning that we use. There's no reason to assume from the outset that your life only matters, the things you do with your life only matter if they are very famous, if they make you very famous or very wealthy, or if they echo down the centuries, or if people in 200 years from now will be living differently as a result of something that you did, or remember your name, all these things that our culture, I think, strongly emphasizes. It's that kind of ethos of needing to be significant in a particular way that drives the notion that growth and scaling and making your company bigger and bigger and bigger is somehow an intrinsic good. If you can let go of that, you can begin to see the benefits of there's nothing wrong with just having a one person operation and making a small difference in the world and connecting to a few people and helping a few people. A model that is really interesting and inspiring in a way individual psychotherapists in private practice. I think this is always a really interesting thing to think about, right? These are not people who are settling for jobs where they don't use their minds, right? This is work that you bring your whole self to. Mm-hmm. It's really important. People usually get into that because it really matters to them. But kind of all you can do is take on a certain number of clients and hope that you help those people. Nobody would say, well, that it only counts if you become famous and are affecting the lives of thousands and thousands of people. I think there's something really sort of beautiful about that idea of it happening on that scale where it can be so real.
Yeah, no, that's completely true. I wonder if you could explain kind of how you came to channel all of this thinking that you'd been doing for such a long time, and obviously you've written other books as well, but into a book about the amount of time that we have in a human lifetime and how we use it. Kind of where did that come from? And I love this idea of, how would you pronounce it? Finitude?
I say finitude. Some people respond like I invented that word. I don't know. I certainly didn't.
But the idea that you get to enjoy the tiny slice of human experience that you do get to have and let go of the huge realm of human experience that you can't possibly have. In the book, you say you don't want to sound Pollyanna-ish about it, but the sense of amazement that you are here at all, that any of us are here at all. Was that the kind of root of the book itself? Was that where it came from? Or did you kind of come to that conclusion during the writing of the book?
In one sense, like, it's just a book about the meaning of life, right? Like all books are on some level, I think.
Yep.
And what is there other than the question of how to make the most of the time that we have here on the planet? The specific thing is that I think it is really, one thing I came to see about myself is that this particular thing of trying to get control over my daily time through productivity techniques, through ways of organizing myself and my work, and through sort of ways of trying to develop self-discipline, that was my particular sort of expression of this timeless struggle. And I think it's not at all unique, especially these days. I think it's a very sort of common one that's well serviced by huge industry of people promising to help with it. So that time management piece specifically was like my way of connecting to this in a way that really like gets at me in my gut. I think that's helpful even for readers for whom that isn't their specific expression of it. The thing underneath that is almost too broad to be a topic. It's just like, you know, how do we handle being alive? Which to me is in some sense the only topic you would ever really want to think about.
Yeah.
Again, that I'm sure that actually is a symptom of a particular cast of mind, but hopefully where it goes by the end of the book anyway is not just useful for people who've approached it through this particular lens of, you know, always feeling like they're fighting against the number of hours in the day and trying to figure out how to structure their work day. I think that is a heck of a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're speaking to an enormous majority. And in fact, I was just trying to think as you were talking in my head whether I know anybody for whom that isn't the case, the kind of struggle with the hours in the day to a greater or lesser extent. And I can't think of anybody who doesn't frame their time in conversation with me, friends, family, who doesn't feel that way, which might be who I choose to spend my time with. But I think it's just that it's almost universal.
Yeah, there are certain forms of work that are so structured that it does still arise. And I'd be on thin ice suggesting that, say, teachers didn't feel in a constant struggle with time, because I know they do. It takes a different form when a lot of your life is kind of timetabled for you. Mm-hmm. You know, there are definitely people for whom organize your workday differently is not a good solution to any of these problems. But yeah, I think the basic predicament, if you're in long-term unemployment, you're probably not going to say that you're busy. But your limited time is still a problem to you because you're using it up in a way that you would presumably rather not. So, you know, the underlying drama is kind of for everyone, I think.
Yeah, I think that's true. I wondered if we could talk a bit about the efficiency trap and the insidiousness of convenience, because again, that was part of it that I felt really chimed with me and my experience, like this idea that if you can be efficient and you can make use of every convenience that is available to you, that you could in some sense get it all done and, as you put it, clear the decks. I just loved kind of being pulled up on that stuff, that actually it's never going to happen. I mean, it's like the John Maynard Keynes essay from the 30s, The Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, where he talks about how he thinks that people in more or less now will be only working, I think, is it 15 hours a week or 17 hours a week because of all of the right. efficiencies which we will have generated by in the interim period. And obviously that hasn't happened at all, because what happens when things get more efficient? We just fill the time with more tasks. I found that really arresting, that notion that convenience doesn't necessarily mean ease. Where in your life have you found that to be the case? Where is convenience kind of failed?
What I'm trying to get at there is just, it's the most obvious thing. It's the most obvious way to attempt a solution, right? If you have too much to do, you feel like you need to cram much more into your life in order to, I don't know, achieve a sense of self-worth or something, then the obvious ways to do it are to try to do the work and the things that you have to do quicker in less time so that you can pack more in, and to try to get certain tasks that you are just really annoying out of your life entirely. Mm. If you could eliminate the tedious stuff and speed up the other stuff, you would imply, you know, it feels like you might get to this point where you were finally doing all the things that you felt you needed to. And the point I make in the book is that, you know, if the supply of things is effectively infinite, and I think it is in all sorts of different domains, email, social obligations, family responsibilities, then it's not a wise tactic to try to get through it all quicker with efficiency techniques, because you'll never get through it. And actually, you'll generate more tasks, mostly following that methodology. I think just more generally, I've always been under the illusion or under the belief that there's some way of organizing my day that is consistent with my rhythms and my energy cycles that will just make it effortless. And I don't think that's how it works on reflection. And, you know, I'm still totally full for this. I'm still feel frustrated when I don't get to begin my work at an early hour like I am convinced is absolutely best for my particular energy cycles. And, you know, I do think I'd have a better day when I get to do my deeply focused work early in the morning. But it doesn't ever, even if I had that every single day for the next 6 months, I'm no longer under the illusion I would get to this sort of paradise of I'm on top of everything, nobody's waiting for me, I haven't missed any deadlines, you know, there's nothing I feel I ought to be doing that I haven't done. Losing that illusion is so powerful and empowering, I think.
It sounds very liberating and like something worth striving for much more than getting everything off your to-do list.
One of our sponsors this season is PensionBee, a way to make setting up a self-employed pension easier. They do a pension specifically for self-employed people, so you can vary your contributions according to your income. One of the things that puts us solo workers off getting a pension is feeling like we won't always be able to afford to contribute. But this way, you can put in lump sums when you get paid for that big job, or trickle money in when things feel a little more precarious. Only 24% of self-employed people contribute into a private pension, even though in the UK, the government will top up our contributions. Go to pensionbee.com/self-employed pension to find out more. Download the app or head to pensionbee.com for more information. Your capital is at risk. As I mentioned earlier, this season of The Solo Collective is sponsored by Tide. Tide has developed a platform for small businesses, which you can use without opening a bank account with them. It's called Cashflow Insights. Regardless of which bank you use for business banking, you can connect it to the Tide platform, and within 24 hours, you'll be getting insights such as cash flow predictions, credit score monitoring, and advice about your income and outgoings. It can even tell you your credit status and help you look for business finance with no impact on your credit score. Connect your business bank account today to Tide and receive a £75 Uber or Uber Eats voucher. Limited availability. Terms and conditions apply. Download the app or Google Tide Cashflow Insights to find out more.
I'm going to guess that you think part of the problem is about this future chasing mindset, because again, I found that very affecting. This idea that when we get there, somewhere that we'll have a sort of, I don't know, like a Nirvana-ish experience. There will be this kind of mythical state where there isn't a long to-do list. And I think it's particularly relevant for people who work by themselves because of the kind of sometimes meandering paths that solitary careers can go on. I think we often spend quite a lot of time in our solo careers working towards something or with some quite distant aim in mind, or maybe the aim isn't even that clear. It's not that we're going to be made partner and get a corner office. You know, there's a kind of when I'm successful, vague thing looming over several mountains away in the distance that continues to recede the faster you try and walk towards it. So I think I think it's a highly relevant thing to try and shake off that mindset. I mean, is it just a question of knowing that it doesn't help, that we can kind of shake that off? Or is there another way that we can try and free ourselves from that notion that in the future it will be better?
I write a lot about this, and I often tend to assume I'm talking mainly about the idea that, like, in several years' time, that will be when everything comes together and you can finally relax and do your work, etc., etc. I don't think this is something you should be trying to sort of uproot and eradicate from your brain. It's totally natural. And it comes from this sort of ambition that we have, I think, to want to be more in control of our time and feel more confident about meeting everything that feels like we ought to be doing with our time than we in fact are. I think the real problem comes when you're deferring things that are significantly important to you to this future time that never arrives, and that the main way to deal with that is just to make sure that there is some aspect of your day-to-day life now that finds time for those things now, even if you don't feel ready for them. It's one thing to think, okay, I'll get more time to read a bunch of books. It's another thing to think, like, it's 2 years before I can really launch the project that I want to be the centerpiece of what I'm doing as a solo worker, because first of all I have to insert something here.
Yeah.
Could be financial security, could be something to do with your home life, could be something to do with your skills and qualifications. And so the thing I try really hard to make sure I'm doing, I don't always succeed, but on the level of the day and the week, is to put in there some of the things that I know are the most important to me, and not to wait till the decks are cleared and it feels easy to do them. So on the simplest level, this is just the attempt I make most days to spend the first sort of 3 or 4 working hours of the day on focused work, on specific projects with defined endpoints that are the parts of my work that tax my brain, to the extent possible, happen in the hours when I'm least likely to be interrupted. And then I sort of schedule other things, like a conversation like this, for outside of those times. And that's, you know, it's not a magic solution. It's a pretty obvious thing that a lot of solo workers and writers especially already do, I know. The reason that that's working for me, I think, is because it sort of deposits front and center in the day a chunk of time that is on the things that I feel my working life is really about, instead of putting them off to a point when I've got my whole sort of work finances systems in place and I've invoiced people who need invoicing and I've answered all my emails and I've got my workspace set up how I think I need it to be. Because one thing I know is that is an infinite quantity of things, and they're important. You know, you can't ignore your email, and it's nice to have a good workspace, but I think you've got to make them second tier in your day. So that's just one way. The principle is the important thing, and I don't particularly try to harangue people to implement the principle the way I want.
Yeah, that leads me on to thinking about your writing on procrastination and the idea perhaps that there's two kinds of procrastination, and one of them is born out of fear, the one that really sort of stops you working. Something similar a few years back, and I felt like it was quite a big sort of aha moment when I realized that most procrastination for me and others around me isn't born out of laziness or disorganization or anything really to do with temperament, that it's to do with the fear that you can't do the thing that you're supposed to be doing. I thought the way you wrote about that was really interesting.
I think there are lots of reasons for procrastination, but the one I really sort of zero in on in the book, at least when I'm talking about bad procrastination, because I do have a whole riff about how a certain kind of procrastination is just inevitable all the time,
yeah.
Right? There are too many things to do, so you're going to be neglecting some of them. But when it comes to that holding back on projects that you really care about, I think a very important factor in that is usually this sense that the fantasy that exists only in your mind is perfect and comforting and reassuring, and maybe it's absolutely brilliant and it's the kind of thing that's going to get you the adulation of the world when they see it. To actually bring it into reality, you've got to take it away from the world of fantasy and start to have it encounter reality. And it's inevitable that this won't measure up to the fantasy, that it will be harder, that you won't be confident that you can do it, that it won't exactly match the original fantasy, that you won't get to control how people respond to it and all the rest of it. So I think people, a lot of the time, all of us to some extent, you know, harbour these fantasies about the future, and we're quite happy that they're fantasies about the future, because were they to become reality, they would challenge us and make us feel uncomfortable. The thing to remember here, I think, is that if you can see what I'm saying, grasp what I'm saying about the inevitability of this, right? That when it gets out into the world, it is inevitably not the perfect fantasy. Mm. That's when it becomes quite empowering and motivating, because you can see that, like, nobody can get around that fact. There's no benefit in waiting till you're certain you can do it with no loss of perfection. There's no reason to beat yourself up about lacking the skills or whatever else it might be to do it perfectly. If you can see that it's built into the situation, then it becomes a question of, like, well, you might as well start that project now. You might as well make that phone call now. You might as well do that thing now. I'm not saying there aren't specific contexts, you know, don't start practicing surgery until you've become qualified as a surgeon, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the basic idea that we're all in this boat, that bringing things into the world is by definition an act of sort of surrendering to their imperfections, I think that can really free people up to be like, oh, all right then, what am I waiting for?
To what extent did the writing of this book change you, do you think? Did you discover new things about how you operated, or discover new ways to operate as you? Or was it a kind of distillation of all the stuff that you had been thinking about for such a long time already?
No, it's definitely the former, in the sense that it's like, it's a process, writing for me anyway, I think it's probably pretty universal. I'd be interested in your thoughts about this. To me, it's the process of figuring out what you think. And in the context of advice, it's of giving yourself the advice you need to hear. And then, you know, in order to write it authentically, I think you do have to change a bit. I think that there are passages in this book that, once I'd figured out what I wanted to say, it would have been very strange to go on living in entirely unchanged and just be, you know, lecturing somebody else about the right way to do it. So it is the act of changing. You know, there's that very famous saying, it's easier to act your way into new ways of thinking than to think your way into new ways of acting. Mm. And in this context, even though it involved a lot of thinking, the book is like an action, right? It's like I was putting this together and sort of bringing myself along with it. Instead of, first of all, I've figured everything out and now I generously am willing to share it with you mere mortals. Yeah, no, definitely not.
Yeah, definitely. I feel the same. I have still got bits of my book to apply to myself. I find myself doing things that I've written about from the point of view of academic research, and, you know, the proof is this, and the best way to attempt X is to do Y or whatever. And every now and then my husband will sort of see me doing something different that he knows was in the book, and he'll say, oh, I see you're finally following your own advice.
Yeah, right, totally. Or yes, and this happens to me too, right? I'll be sort of moaning about some aspect of my work, and my wife will sardonically say, like, you know, I read a really good book about this once. This might have some useful advice for you in it, meaning my own book. But, you know, I think the one thing that we can do, this is just inevitable, and I'm just trying to be honest about it, right? I mean, I don't think I write in the book as if I've sorted it all out. I think an awful lot of the benefit is just in sort of collectively, me and the readers of this book, sort of letting these problems percolate through us a bit, or permeate us, or whatever the right word is, and become a bit more sort of conscious of the ways things work. I absolutely don't, I don't think I claim, and I certainly won't claim now in this conversation, to have solved them all. But yeah, I'm not sure they are solvable in a sort of ultimate sense anyway.
No, and I wasn't meaning to imply that was how you'd written at all. I just...
No, but I just mean it's something baked into advice, which is a confusing notion. And the book is advice, you know, no question. But does a piece of advice automatically imply that the advisor lives it perfectly? I don't think that. I think the world of people offering advice divides into the people who are honest or dishonest about that. And I hope I could be honest about it.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought about when I was reading the bit about being amazed by our own existence, I was thinking about the fact that I have got that mindset, and I have done for a very long time, because it comes from a very sad place. There was quite a lot of loss in my family when I was and friends when I was a teenager, and horrific though that was, and I wouldn't want to minimize it, it did leave me with this sense of kind of what would be the right word, awe, I guess, that I yep. got to be here. But I was also thinking that, you know, although I have that as a kind of overarching philosophical framework, perhaps, for life, it doesn't stop me getting really, really irritated in supermarket queues. You know, you can have right. a cognitively dissonant experience of these things, right? You can know something to yeah. be true on the one hand, and yet still, I should obviously, in the kind of purest sense, I should enjoy every moment of my young children's life, but actually I find a huge amount of it incredibly tedious, boring and infuriating. And
no, of course I will,
it's all true.
Yeah. I will venture, like, firstly that you're better at this than you would have been if you hadn't grasped those things. So the correct comparison is always that, rather than some perfect person.
Yeah.
People ask me, am I are you sort of totally chilled out with regard to time now? And I'm like, absolutely not. I'm better than I used to be. That's the point. And a lot better than I used to be, I think. And then secondly, I think you sort of recover more swiftly from things. Mm. So, like, it's not that you don't fall into, this is a kind of thing that you hear meditation teachers say, right? It's not that you don't fall into irritation and lose consciousness of what's going on and what's the best way to handle things. It's that you get back on the wagon a little bit faster than you otherwise would have done.
Mm. Yeah, I do get back on the wagon faster than I might otherwise do, but I still hate your supermarket queues.
That's okay. I give you permission.
I really loved learning more about how Oliver works, as well as about the book itself. I think it's really critical, I hope that's not too strong a way of putting it, that we learn as solo workers about how other solo workers get it done, because I think so often we feel as though we're flailing about and have no idea how to do this stuff. And so I love conversations where you get a bit of a window on how someone else has built the life that seems to work for them in a way that can hopefully be sort of inspiring, even though you can't kind of carbon copy somebody else's way of doing things. I just think the book is such a valuable one. I think that shedding ideas around whether we can ever master our own time completely, it's so liberating, it's so valuable. So I'm really grateful to him for writing it, and I hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you want to find out more about Oliver, you can go to oliverberkman.com, and he is also on Twitter at oliverberkman. If you want more from me, you can find me on Instagram at bexseal, bexseal, and on Twitter at rebeccaseal. There's more about working alone on my website, howtoworkalone.com. And also, if I could just ask you a little favour, if you can just tell one other solo worker about this podcast, anyone you think would benefit from it, that would really help us, as would if you leave us a review and a rating wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. This series is brilliantly produced by Hester Kant.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.